Chapter 56. I take it from your expression that there are no further emails. Marcy sat behind the wheel of Jack's car, outside a strip mall Starbucks in the West Oahu town of Waipahu. Summer slid onto the passenger seat with his laptop. Jack had taken a room in a motel in Kaneohe since the day he learned that Glenn had visitors. Jack and Marcy were now being careful how they met up and where they went. Nothing. Not a word in days. Every day we drive to a different town, to a different Wi-Fi spot. Every day I get my hopes up. No, I've come to believe you were right. They gave me false information to lure me into the open. Marcy looked at him sympathetically. I'm sorry. I gotta go back to Chicago and confront these guys. I know who's involved in all the details. I know where the grapes of wrath are stored. I can put them all behind bars. They can't afford to double-cross me. Marcy grabbed his forearm. Jack, that's foolish. You know everything about them and what they've done. That's exactly why you can't go back. It's just what they want you to do. No one else is left to put them behind bars. But I don't understand why you need them at all. You've got the money. Find a way to make your own deal.
Summer shook his head.
It's not as simple as that. I need these guys. They have the contacts in the Middle East. Jack, if you go back to Chicago, you'll get arrested, or worse, you'll get killed.
She leaned over and put her arm around his shoulder.
Please, don't do something stupid, Jack.
Marcy, I'm not going to fail Sophie again. If you have any sense, you'll bow out of this right now. Get out and cut your losses. I knew when I got into this scheme that I'd probably never get away with it. Divert the money, rescue Sophie, and live happily ever after in Hawaii? Pretty far-fetched. But there was an opportunity to save Sophie. Grab it or lose it. And I kept thinking, we must take the current when it serves. The tide was right for me. It was my chance, and I grabbed it. I had to. The guy gave me a plan when I had none.
But Jack, it was my only shot at getting my daughter out of Palestine.
But in the end, I was naive and foolish. Now I gotta go back to Chicago. I might still be able to put this deal back together.
If you go back there, you're more likely to lose your life than put a deal back together.
You might be right, but I have no choice. In any event, it's time for you to get out of this mess. You know, I'm fond of you, Marcy. But this is the wrong time and place.
I hope you don't mean that.
Summers nodded and hung his head. It was wrong for me to let you get involved. I shouldn't have kept calling you. It was purely selfish on my part.
Selfish because you need someone?
Don't say that. You're not just someone, he said quietly.
Selfish because you can't go through this alone? Because maybe you have feelings?
He nodded.
Maybe so, but it's the wrong time for the two of us. Well, maybe I don't agree.
She smiled.
Why don't I contact Liam Taggart? He said he could help.
Summers shook his head.
He didn't have a solution. What can he do? I don't know. He said he was going to be on the ground in Israel. It can't hurt to find out what he has in mind. Tell Deborah to text him and I'll meet him in L.A.
I can't allow you to go back to L.A.
You can't allow me? Don't I have a say in this? If I want to go to L.A., I'll go to L.A. There has to be some way this all works out. I'm going to help us find that way.
No, you don't have a say in this. I was, and I still am, willing to sacrifice myself. I'm not willing to sacrifice you.
Jack, I'm going to L.A., and you can't talk me out of it.
You're crazy, you know that? You may be even crazier than I am.
He shifted around in the car seat.
Damn you, Marcy.
The two sat silently in the car, staring at each other. Finally, Jack said,
You're a good friend, and I'm lucky to have you on my side. The only thing I can figure is that the fates must have been looking down and seen this poor sap sitting in a ratty motel room in Honolulu, burying his troubles in a bottle of scotch. Boy, has life fucked him over, the fates must have said. It must be time to give this guy a break. So they dangled this travel brochure in my face with a picture of McDuffie's by the sea. Why don't you drive out there for dinner, they said. and those same fates probably made you thirsty and whispered in your ear, "Hey, Marcy, how about a beer at McDuffie's?" That's the only explanation for why you and I are in this car at this time. He leaned over and kissed her on the cheek. Nothing else makes any sense to me. That was no kiss. Don't you give me a peck on the cheek. She cupped his face and kissed him hard. I'll accept that theory. The fates put us together. Now we're going to get Sophie back. And it's permissible for me to think about a future, if I want to. There's no future, Marcy. Yes, there is. As they drove north, Jack said, "Okay, this is the deal. Whatever we do, I insist you cannot cross the line. You can go to L.A., but you cannot do anything illegal. I will not let you implicate yourself criminally or become an accomplice or an accessory after the fact. Deal?" She nodded.
"Deal."
"At some point, Marcy, you just may have to cooperate and turn me in."
"That's never going to happen. I'm a Bonnie riding with my Clyde.
I won't let you do that. You're not going down with my ship. The moment they start closing in, we separate. Promise me."
"No, I won't, because then I'd be admitting to that possibility. There has to be a way that everything works out. I just believe it. You're going to get Sophie back. You're going to return the money, and there won't be any charges."
"Even you don't believe that."
"Jack, I won't concede that there's a dead end. I don't know how, I just know it's going to work out. Why else would the fates have made me thirsty?"
Chapter 57. A blue and white tour bus approached the highway checkpoint from the east. The painted logos on the side of the bus read, "Holy Land Tours." The driver smiled as he presented his credentials to the guards. The passengers were each examined, and once the security screenings were completed, the tour bus drove on to Jerusalem and then to the central bus station. One by one, the passengers alighted, each thanking the driver and the armed security guards for the wonderful educational tour of Hebron and the Tomb of the Patriarchs. The driver expressed his deep appreciation for the gratuities from several of the passengers. Once the security personnel and the tourists had disembarked and the bus was emptied, the driver headed west to an industrial part of Jerusalem. He pulled into an open loading dock of a one-story warehouse. The sign of the front facade read, "Global Fisheries, Cold Storage." Once the bus was in, the overhead door was closed. Three men opened the bus's luggage compartment and unscrewed the metal floor panels. From beneath the floor, six boxes were carefully removed and carried into a refrigerated storage room. Mediterranean Medical Supply Company was stenciled on the side of each of the boxes. In the storage room, they were placed on a pallet alongside other similar boxes. The driver returned to the bus, replaced the metal floor panels, and backed out of the Global Fisheries loading area. His job completed, the driver returned the bus to the yard where it would not be needed until next Tuesday's run to Hebron. HPD Captain Grant Okoye handed a slip of paper to Communication Sergeant Donna Miwa. "I need an alert to go out to all 8 divisions. We're looking for a guy named Eugene Wilson. DMV records show he purchased a 2008 Blue Acura, license number 175889. We want him picked up for questioning."
"What did he do, Captain?"
"I don't know that he did anything. The detectives who were investigating the Coral Reef homicide found a motel register on the chest of the dead clerk. Wilson's name was circled on the register. The deceased had his arms around the book when he got shot. There's a good chance that Wilson's name was circled for a reason. My gut tells me he must know something. I want to bring him in."
"Yes, sir, I'll put the alert out. It'll be on the screens within 10 minutes.
15 minutes later, two civilians in shorts and tank tops, sitting in a black Cadillac, saw the alert on their laptop.
"Thank you, Marvin," said the shorter one.
Just as Al-Zahani was finishing dinner, his cell phone rang. It was Fakir.
"Harif, Danny's mother is trying to reach you. He's very sick. Tell her I will meet him at the clinic. She says he cannot get out of bed. Then I will go to their home."
Danny and his family lived in a 3-story walk-up in the center of the city. A dry cleaner's occupied the first floor, filling the hallways with tetrachloroethylene fumes. Al-Zahani covered his nose with a handkerchief as he climbed the stairs to Donnie's apartment. These people would probably die from the carcinogens in the air anyway, he thought. Donnie's mother, barefoot and in a robe, answered the door.
Oh, thank you, doctor, for coming here. Donnie is so sick. There is blood in his stool. You can help him, though, right? You can cure him, give him medicines.
Al-Zahani followed her into the bedroom. The stench of vomit and urine, rancid and sour, was overpowering. Donnie was lying face up on his bed, sweating profusely from a high fever and barely cognizant of his surroundings. Al-Zahani examined him carefully, stretching the boy's eyelids to peer deeply into his eyes. He wiped his burning forehead with a cloth. Donnie narrowed his eyes and tried to focus. In a rasping, broken whisper, barely audible to the doctor, he said,
You did this to me, didn't you? You fucker! You did this!
Finally, the doctor reached into his bag and withdrew a syringe and a bottle of morphine. He gave Donnie a strong dose.
That will help him sleep,
Al-Zahani said to the worried mother, wiping his hands with sanitizer.
I will have an ambulance bring him to the clinic in the morning.
As the doctor walked away from the apartment building, his cell phone buzzed again.
Arif, Faiz would like to see you.
Now?
It's midnight. He says we are to gather at his home.
As Al-Zahani pulled up to the curb outside Faiz's one-story stone residence, he noticed Fakir's car and Nizar's car were parked there as well. A quiet young woman showed him into a sitting room, where Faiz reclined on a pillowed couch. Nizar and Fakir stood to either side.
How is young Dani?
Faiz said.
He will die tomorrow, Al-Zahani said.
Peace be with him.
Why are we meeting here tonight? The apartment building where we have been meeting has been closed by the health department,
Fakir said.
They say they found rats and infestation. It's probably true. It's the IDF. They know we meet, Fakir said.
Nonsense. The IDF doesn't condemn buildings, said Nizar with disgust. No matter, Faiz said. We cannot meet there anymore. We must meet again in the back room of the bakery.
My bakery? No way,
Fakir said.
The IDF! Screamed Nizar. Why do you keep saying that? The IDF does not operate in Hebron. They know nothing. We need to meet, and you have the room. I know the elegant doctor does not want us in his pristine palace, he said with a sneer.
Enough, said Faiz. We will meet at the bakery. What is the status of our shipments?
3 busloads have passed through, Nizar said smugly.
Aziz is doing his job. His bus is indistinguishable from the Hebrew tour bus. Aziz unloads the containers at the cold storage center and waits until another day to bring more tourists to see the tomb. Then he returns with 6 other containers. Unlike the good doctor, he is right on schedule.
Faiz smiled and stroked his mottled beard.
Good. Very good. We will use that warehouse for our Tel Aviv and Haifa operations as well. How many of these IV units do we now have in Jerusalem?
1,840 1,000-milliliter bags, Arif answered. Most are common saline solutions. But we have also provided a number of 2.5% dextrose-added solutions to make sure we can satisfy the medical demands. All of the bags bear the identical imprints of Sexton International, the American healthcare company that supplies Mediterranean Medical Supply, the distribution center in Jerusalem. I defy any nurse or technician to tell the difference.
And the rest, Arif? Are we making more?
Of course. 40 a day. I am working on a process to increase to 60 a day. By the summer, we will have many thousands. But for our immediate needs, we will surely be ready by April 16th.
Faiz rubbed his hands together and smiled wide.
This is such good news.
Ahmed, have you talked to Sami? Are we confident he knows his responsibility?
He knows. Every morning he makes his delivery run.
Mediterranean gives him a printout of his route. So many units to deliver to this hospital, so many to that. He knows on April 16th to make the switch at the global fisheries. Then he will deliver Arif's bags. He'll do fine.
Faiz stood and reached for the hands of Fakir and Al-Zahani. He shook them hard.
From the river to the sea, my friends. From the Golan to the Gulf.
Before we leave,
Fakir said,
I have passed around some information onto Abu Hamad.
I told him that Arif will return the girl for $5 million.
Did you tell him to come alone to Hebron?
Of course.
Faiz looked at Al-Zahani.
Well, if he is foolish enough to come here, then it's a simple matter to dispose of him and fill our coffers with his money.
Call for you, Captain.
This is Okoye.
Captain, this is Trooper Colin Watanabe. I saw your APB for Eugene Wilson. I stopped this guy Wilson a few weeks ago for speeding on Highway 99, heading for the North Shore. Blue Acura. License 175889. I remember the guy. Straw hat. Real nervous. I gave him a warning. I'll keep an eye out for him, but you might want to alert the patrols in Haleiwa and Waialua.
Okoye ordered his communications sergeant to amend the APB for Wilson. Last seen on the North Shore, blue Acura, license 175889. The alert was soon seen on the patrol car computer screens and on the laptop in the black Cadillac.
Chapter 58. Marcy handed the keys to Jack outside the harbor char house.
You'll have to drive us home. One too many martinis for me.
Jack grinned. The ride along the North Shore that night was peaceful. It mirrored their mood. They had each other. They had a plan to contact Liam. Their luck was sure to change. They didn't notice the sedan parked on the street near Marcy's house when they pulled into her driveway. Jack opened the passenger door for Marcy, put his arm around her shoulder, and walked with her to the front door. As they unlocked the door, they heard sounds of car doors opening and shutting. They turned and saw two figures walking toward the house. Quickly, they entered the house and locked the door.
"Did you get a look at them?"
whispered Marcy. "Not really. It's dark. A big guy got out of the driver's side." Summers took his phone from his pocket.
"What are you doing?"
"I'm calling 911.
"Are you crazy? You can't talk to the police. Get out of here. Go out the back door and head down to the beach.
And leave you here?" "No way. I'll stall them. You go out the back door." The doorbell rang.
"Come on, Jack. The two of us, we can make it to the beach."
The doorbell rang again.
"It doesn't matter. They found me. Run, Marcy, get the hell out of here."
He started to press the numbers on his phone. She slowly pulled back the draperies, just enough to get a glimpse of the front porch.
"Wait. It's a man and a woman," she whispered. "Don't call yet."
"A woman can fire a gun."
"Glenn said it was two men."
Marcy flipped on the porch lights.
"It's Taggart. It's Liam Taggart."
She turned the deadbolt and swung the door open. Liam and Kayla entered the hallway. Summers stood in the middle of the room and made no effort to move. Marcy backed up and sat on the arm of her couch.
"How did you find us?"
"Doesn't matter," Liam said.
"Well, yeah, it does. Did you follow me from L.A.?
Liam shook his head. "You opened your purse when you paid the bill. I saw your ID."
"You looked in my purse? You goddamn snoop!"
Liam smiled and tilted his head. "I'm a private investigator. I snoop for a living."
"That doesn't mean you can look in a woman's purse. Didn't your mother teach you any manners? You violated my privacy."
"I deeply apologize. Can we move off this subject?" Gesturing towards Summers, Liam said, "I assume this is Jack?"
"Maybe,"
Marcy said.
"And are you going to introduce the person that came in with you?"
"Sorry, this is Kayla Cummings. She's a spy. We just want to talk."
"I'm not saying anything,"
Jack said.
"Jack, would you relax?"
said Marcy.
"One's a private investigator and the other's a spy. They found us and they didn't bring the cops.
So they've come out here for a reason, and I'd like to know what it is.
Thank you, Marcy, Liam said, still standing by the door. May we come in?
I'm sorry. Now I'm the one who has no manners. Please.
She gestured to the couch.
Would either of you like a soft drink or a glass of water?
Water from me, thank you, said Liam.
I'll have a glass as well, Kayla said.
Marcy started for the kitchen, then stopped.
Or beer, if you'd like.
Now you're talking, Liam said.
I'll stick with the water, Kayla said.
Marcy returned to the living room with the tray. She placed the drinks on the table.
3 beers and a glass of water for the spy.
Kayla pursed her lips and scolded Liam with her eyes. With all 4 sitting around the coffee table, Marcy said,
To tell the truth, Mr. Taggart, I was planning on contacting Deborah to meet with you again. But now that you've discovered where we live, you go first. What do you want?
Liam took a sip of beer, pointed his index finger at Marcy. I like this girl, Jack. She's got spunk. She's a tough little firecracker. No kidding, Jack said. Liam took another drink.
I saw Sophie.
Summers leaned forward.
You did? Where did you see her? Did you talk to her?
Liam shook his head.
Didn't talk to her. She's in Hebron, and she appears to be fine.
We saw her from a distance. She didn't know we were there. Summers looked at Kayla.
You went too?
Kayla nodded.
I work for the State Department. We have a mutual interest in Arif al-Zahani.
Why didn't you bring her back?
Liam answered. It's not that simple. Can we start at the beginning and have this conversation on a more organized platform?
Jack nodded.
If you didn't go to retrieve Sophie, can you tell me why you went to Hebron?
We were under the impression that there was an arrangement to pay a ransom to al-Zahani for Sophie's return, Kayla said. The U.S. cannot allow $88 million or any sum to be paid to suspected terrorists.
He's a terrorist?
We think so, Kayla said. We think his group is planning something.
Well, Jack said, I also believe there was an arrangement to pay a ransom. But I'm beginning to doubt the deal was ever made.
So are we, Liam said.
You wasted your time coming all the way out here.
I don't have any money here.
You can have me arrested, but that's not going to get Kelson his money.
We can talk about that later.
I think there's a play here, and you might want to consider it.
All I want is Sophie, and I'm not interested in talking to anyone about anything until Sophie is returned.
Marcy reached out and touched his arm. Jack, why don't we listen to what he has to say instead of digging our heels in?
Liam nodded and pointed his finger at Marcy again. This girl's got common sense, Jack. You'd be smart to listen to her.
Summer sat back in his chair.
Okay. I'm listening.
First, I'm going to advise you that your country wants your help. That ought to tell you that there might be something in it for you. It could be a little dangerous, but it might be a way to rescue Sophie and do yourself some good.
I don't care if it's dangerous. I'd do anything.
I know you would. Why don't you begin by telling me how this whole embezzlement scheme began?
Jack took a sip of his beer, set the bottle down, and drew a deep breath.
That Sunday, when Sophie didn't come home on time,
I knew in the pit of my stomach they had snatched her.
I immediately called the police and the FBI. I told them to alert the airports, the train stations. We put out an Amber Alert.
Jack shook his head.
I don't know how they got out of the country. The FBI monitored all the flights. I was sure he took her back to Hebron, but as you already know, he's got quite a fortress. It's not like I could go knock on his door and take my daughter. And it's not like I could call the Hebron police and show them my court order. So I went the political route. I tried everything, every U.S. agency, every foreign agency, everything. Do you understand? There was nothing I could do. I had hit a stone wall. Then, maybe a couple of weeks later, Dennis Harrington calls and tells me to meet him at the Rocket Bar and Grill up near Wrigley Field.
We were both working on the sale of his company, so I figured it had to do with a problem in the paperwork. He's the CFO of Kelsen Manufacturing, and my law firm was representing Kelsen. They were selling out to Leland Industries. The net profit payable to Kelsen was over $90 million. We sat in a booth in the corner of the bar, and Harrington starts by telling me how sorry he feels that Sophie was kidnapped.
How did he know?
Shit, everyone knew. There was an Amber Alert. It was on the damn TV. So Harrington says, why don't you go get her or offer the guy money to return her? I told him that Al-Zahani was very wealthy and well-protected, and besides, I didn't have that kind of money. So we talk some more, and Harrington says, Kelsen's such an asshole. He's been on my case for 20 years, and I'm glad he's selling his company. Then he leans over, and he says quietly, if you help me get back at him, I can help you with your daughter. That's obvious to me that Harrington wants to run some kind of scheme on Kelsen, and I'm also certain there's no way this middle-aged accountant can help me do anything to get Sophie out of Hebron. I tell him his problems with Kelsen are his business, and I don't see that he's in any position to help me. He looks at his watch and says, not so fast. You want your daughter, don't you? I know a guy. He's real important. He can make things happen. He's the kind of guy who can get Sophie back for you. I'm listening, I said. Give me a few minutes, he says, and he gets up to make a phone call. 10 minutes later, a man walks into the bar. My first impression is this guy is made of money. He's dressed in a camel cashmere coat, white silk scarf. He smiles, hands his coat to his driver, and slides into our booth. He's got a diamond ring on his little finger, a Patek Philippe watch, a tailored suit with a silk pocket square, and a thick Russian accent. We're in a neighborhood bar, and he looks like he's sitting down for a $500 dinner on Michigan Avenue. He sits right next to me and orders a vodka martini straight up. I'm very sorry to hear this thing about your daughter, he says. I myself have a child, and I don't know what I'd do if someone tried to take him from me. I say thank you for your concern.
Did this man give you his name?
Liam asked. He did not, but when he left, I heard his driver call him Dimitri. Liam turned to Kayla.
Does that mean anything to you?
Kayla shook her head.
No.
What else did Dimitri say to you? Asked Liam. Nothing, to begin with. He just drank his vodka and made small talk. Then he moved the conversation to the Middle East. He told me he had just returned from Dubai. He had business interests all throughout the Middle East, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. He told me it was important for his business to have discreet relationships with highly placed officials throughout the Middle East. As a result, he could get things done in Arab countries. Especially, he says, in the lands of the Palestinians. Dennis has told me of your sad story, and I can help you. I can get your daughter back for you. I said, how are you going to do that? He smiled. He smugly tipped his head from side to side. It can be done. What do you want from me? I said. He didn't answer directly, but he said, getting your little Sophie back will be no problem for me. He shrugged like it was as simple as ordering a pizza. I can be a very good friend to you. I will talk to this Al-Zahani, and he will make agreement. That is what I do. I make agreements. I'm a fair man. When I propose a business transaction, it's fair. People never turn me down, especially not some pipsqueak like this Palestinian doctor. Then he breaks into this sardonic laugh. Ha, ha, ha. But it isn't a laugh, it's a warning. And even if this Al-Zahani is foolish enough to turn me down, I am certain the Palestine authorities will help me. I'm a big supporter. I say, that is very good of you. I don't know why you would offer to do this. What can I do in return? He smiled and said, I do this partly because it is wrong to kidnap a man's child, and partly because I myself need a favor. Now the sweat starts running off my brow. I don't know what he's going to ask me to do, but I've already crossed the line. Short of murdering someone, there isn't much I wouldn't do to get Sophie back. All you have to do is sign a paper, he says. Nothing more.
And the paper is the escrow instruction for wiring the $88 million?
Liam said.
Correct. So, now you're in a fix,
Liam said. You do what he asks, and maybe you get Sophie in return. Or you refuse. No. You can't refuse. That's not an option. Remember, no one turns him down. Ha, ha, ha. At that point, I had no choice. But truth be told, I'd have agreed anyway if there was even a spark of hope to get Sophie. He said that Harrington would get in touch with me in a day or two with the details of the plan. With that, he raised his hand, and his driver came over with his coat and the two left the bar.
One question, Liam said. How did you know the other man was his driver?
He had keys in his hand. I just assumed. Liam nodded.
What happened next?
The next day, I got a call from Harrington, and we set a meeting for my office. It was natural because we were busy working on the sale of this company, and he was in our office a lot. It was on a Thursday. He laid out the plan to divert the exchange loan payoff to Panama, but he said that Dimitri wanted me to go to Panama and set up the account.
Me?
Why me? I said. Because Dimitri thinks it will be better, said Harrington. He thinks Kelson will notice if I am gone for 2 days. With that, he hands me a round-trip ticket to Panama City. I set up the account at the First Republic Bank in the name of Capital Investment Funds, Inc., spend the night at the Hilton, and came back the next day. I knew that I couldn't stay in Chicago after we diverted the funds, and my plan started taking shape on that long flight from Panama. If I had any chance of not getting caught right away, I would have to leave before the escrow was scheduled to pay out and the theft was discovered. I knew I'd have to move far away and tell no one where I was going, not even my sister. The funny thing is, I trusted Dimitri. I didn't fear him because I wasn't going to double-cross him. In retrospect, I was a fool. But I really believed that Dimitri would honor his promise. You know, honor among thieves. The farthest place I knew where I could go without using a passport was Hawaii. I'd been here 3 times with Alina. So I start to formulate a plan to move Sophie out to the islands. Deb would find a way to bring her out. We could stay together for a little while until I was sure Sophie was emotionally strong enough for me to leave. If I got caught, Deb would raise her. I cashed in my retirement, set up my own separate Panama accounts, and did everything so I could leave Chicago as soon as the money was wired. I thought there was a good chance for us to hide out as long as we needed to. Stupid, huh? Liam shrugged and nodded.
Yeah. Jack continued.
I wanted to meet with Dimitri again, but he insisted we communicate only through Harrington. In fact, I never saw Dimitri again. I told Harrington that I needed a way to communicate with Dimitri, and we set up this private email account. We'd leave messages for each other in the draft message folder. Dimitri said it might take him a month or two to get Sophie, but there would be no problem, and he'd give me updates by email. The deal was closed, the money was wired to the phony account, and I left town. Now we know he never intended to do anything. Just to trick me into stealing the money.
Jack pursed his lips.
He couldn't do the heist without me. And Sophie's kidnapping provided the perfect opportunity. Guys like this rich Russian, they just seem to stumble onto dumbass luck. He just happened to find Jack Summers. A guy whose daughter had been kidnapped. Who was so desperate he'd do anything. And who just happened to be in control of $88 million.
Liam and Kayla looked at each other and nodded.
It might not have been dumbass luck, Liam said.
You mean Dimitri set up the kidnapping?
Marcy said.
He's the kidnapper?
Liam shook his head.
Alzahani is the kidnapper.
But I think you're right. Dimitri was the guy who set it up.
What an evil son of a bitch! Marcy snapped. Kidnap a man's daughter to force him to steal money.
I didn't have to do it, Marcy. Summer said quietly. I knew right from wrong. I jumped right into his scheme and then set up my escape. There was no reason on earth to trust this guy, but he said what I wanted to hear. And I wanted to believe him, and he knew it.
Don't be too hard on yourself, Liam said. I'd have done the same thing.
Seriously?
Liam nodded.
If it was my kid, yeah. Thanks for that, Jack said. But in the end, I was a fool. I still don't have Sophie. I lost everything I had in Chicago, my career, my reputation, my honor. And now I'm probably going to spend the next 20 years in prison. The only good that came out of any of this was reconnecting with Marcy. Marcy walked over, put her arm around Jack, and kissed him on the cheek. Still, the two of you came all the way out here for nothing, Jack added. Because I don't have the money.
Al-Zahani doesn't know that, Kayla said.
Liam smiled.
You are so right.
Summers furrowed his brow. I don't get it.
Jesus, Jack, even I get it, and I'm not a spy, said Marcy. He might be willing to return her for the money he thinks we have. Am I right?
He's already offered $5 million, Kayla said.
And he believes I have that money? Summers said.
We've told him that you do.
All right, I'm dense, Summers said. A few minutes ago, you said the U.S. cannot allow money to be paid to terrorists.
Right, Liam said.
But you want to make a deal to pay him $5 million out of the money that we don't have.
Right again,
Kayla said.
Look, I don't care how you do it. I just want Sophie out of that man's house. My sister has agreed to raise her. She's a good woman.
There's no doubt of that, Liam said.
I met her. But I also mentioned to you earlier that there may be a play here for you.
Al-Zahani has not only demanded $5 million, he's insisting that he will only make the exchange with you, in person, in Hebron. We need the charade to go down.
I'll do whatever you ask.
We have to be honest with you, Kayla said. The operation will be dangerous. Al-Zahani is part of a terrorist ring. I know for a fact that they have planned and carried out assassinations in the past. There's no reason to believe that Al-Zahani intends to play this straight, and there's every reason to believe that he intends to keep Sophie and the money.
And kill me. I understand.
Wait, Jack, Marcy said. You need to think about this.
She squeezed his arm.
You're not an intelligence agent. You're not a soldier, you're a lawyer. You could easily wind up dead. Let them do this deal. Let Liam go into Hebron disguised as Jack Summers.
Jack shook his head. Arif knows me. It wouldn't work. I've got to do it myself.
Marcy got up and walked quickly over to Liam. Her hands were on her hips. You said there's a play here. Those were your words. What's the play? What can you do for Jack if he risks his life to catch the terrorist? What's in it for him?
Sophie's in it, Marcy, Jack said. It's all about Sophie.
Don't kid yourself,
she said, focusing on Liam.
What's in it for Jack?
Liam smiled. I do like this girl, Jack. You've got a winner here.
He turned to Kayla.
We can pitch the prosecutor, can't we? I'm sure there's a deal to be made.
You can do that, right, Kayla?
Kayla nodded. I'll make the calls and see what can be done. I can't promise anything, but there's a good chance we can do something for you.
Marcy stood behind Summers and held on to his shoulders.
I want Jack exonerated. Jack, don't agree to do anything until they promise to give you immunity. They need you.
Summers patted her hand.
I can't do that, Marcy.
He stood.
I'm in. Whatever you need, I'll go to Hebron with or without a deal.
Just then, red, white, and blue light strobed through the windows and bounced off the walls. There was a hard knock on the door.
Police! Open the door!
Liam held his hand out like a stop sign. I'll handle this. Stay back. He opened the door for two uniformed HPD officers. They had their badges in their hands and walked into the room.
I'm Sergeant Hanley. We're looking for Eugene Wilson. Are you Wilson?
No, Liam said. What's the charge?
Where's Wilson? I need to see all of your IDs,
Hanley said. I'm Wilson, Jack said, walking forward.
You need to come with us, sir.
Kayla stepped forward and took out her wallet.
Hold on, officer,
He's in federal custody. Hanley examined her State Department ID. You're not a federal marshal. Do you have anything else? An arrest warrant? Something showing that you have the present right to take him into custody?
Nothing written, she said. We can make a call, but it's the middle of the night back in Washington.
Hanley looked at his partner and shrugged.
I'm sorry, ma'am, but unless you have something to show that you're federal law enforcement and have a right to take custody of this man, I got my orders to take him downtown for questioning in the death of Glenn Hawkins.
He's dead? Summers's jaw dropped.
Shot through the heart.
This man is a central figure in a federal operation, Sergeant, Kayla said sternly. I need to take him back to Chicago.
Hanley finished cuffing Jack and turned to lead him out the door.
You can pick him up later if he's not charged.
Are you taking him to Wahiawa?
Marcy asked.
No, ma'am, he's going downtown. Pick him up at 801 Beritania.
Liam, Marcy, and Kayla walked outside and watched as Summers was placed in the back seat of the HPD cruiser. A steady rain began to fall. A few houses down, a black Cadillac was parked along the curb. Its lights were off. As the cruiser pulled away from Marcy's home, the Cadillac started up and followed behind.
Did you see that? Liam said.
See what? Kayla said.
The Cadillac. It's trailing the cruiser. Two guys in the front seat.
Shit. We need to get downtown.
I'm coming with you, Marcy said.
No, you better stay here, Kayla said.
We'll call you when he's out. You can't stop me from going. I have my own car. The police department is open to the public, and I'm the public. I'm going, whether you like it or not.
Kayla looked at Liam and shrugged.
Okay, let's go.
Chapter 59. An ambulance picked Donnie up at 11 a.m. He was placed on a stretcher and taken directly to the clinic. His condition had worsened significantly overnight, and he was laid on the hospital bed unconscious. Al-Zahani arrived shortly after noon. He checked Donnie's vitals, said a short prayer, and administered a lethal dose of morphine. The official cause of death was listed as influenza. The ride from the North Shore to Honolulu Police Department headquarters on South Beritania Street, from one side of the island to the other, took about 45 minutes. The rain on the interstate grew stronger. At long last, a golden glow, coming from the lights of downtown Honolulu, appeared through the fog. It was almost midnight as Kayla pulled into a slot on the first level of the parking garage. In the heavy rain, Marcy's umbrella was barely large enough for three to share. As they turned the corner, Liam tapped Kayla's arm.
There, on the street ahead, it's the same black Cadillac. The moat is running, she said. They're waiting for Summers to leave the building.
Inside the station, Liam asked the desk sergeant for Richard Hanley.
He's in an interview, he was told.
Would you tell him that Liam Taggart, one of the people he spoke to earlier this evening in Hale'iwa, thinks that the sergeant may have been followed? The car I saw trailing him is sitting outside. Tell him it has something to do with the case he's investigating, and the guys in the car are dangerous.
A few minutes later, Hanley came into the waiting area. His shirt sleeves were rolled up. He had a pencil tucked onto his right ear.
Mr. Summers is not going to be released tonight, he said to the group. I don't think that he was involved in the murder, but we've got other issues here. Not the least of which is that he's pretending to be his dead brother-in-law to skip out on an Illinois warrant. So you guys can go on home.
You were followed when you left Marcy Grant's house tonight, Liam said. The car, a black Cadillac, is sitting across the street. There are two men in it. I would not be surprised if they're armed and waiting for Mr. Summers to walk out the door. I would also not be surprised if they had something to do with the motel murder.
What makes you think that?
Sergeant, Kayla said. The Illinois warrants you mentioned were issued in connection with an embezzlement. Two other men who are involved in the crime have been murdered. The clerk at the Honolulu Motel where Summers was living was murdered. We have good reason to believe that Summers is the next target.
Do you have prints from the motel? Liam said. Hanley nodded.
Then it might be a good idea for you to take a look at the men in the car. You might find that their prints match.
You got anyone here who speaks Russian?
Russian? It might come in handy with these guys.
Hanley gathered four officers and told them to check out the black Cadillac.
They left the building with weapons drawn. Kayla said, "Sergeant, I've placed a call to the Justice Department in Washington. As I told you, Mr. Summers is critical to a federal operation, my operation. I've asked for a judicial order granting me custody of Mr. Summers for transport back to Chicago. In the meantime, he must be kept under protective custody."
"Oh, he's under custody, all right. He isn't going anywhere."
"I don't want him in general population."
"Look, Ms. Cummings, until I get an order..."
Hanley's response was interrupted by the sound of gunfire on the street. He pulled out a service revolver and headed for the door with Liam close behind. One officer lay in the street. The Cadillac was gone. "They opened fire," an officer said to Hanley. "We approached from both sides. A guy popped out of the passenger door with an automatic weapon. He sprayed the street and the caddy took off. I called in the plates. Adam's down." By this time, several officers and paramedics had gathered. Sirens wailed from the south.
"Sergeant," Kayla said, "do you think you might keep Summers in a secure area tonight?"
He nodded. Chapter 60 Lubana entered the library where Al-Zahani sat reading his paper.
"Arif, the little one is so upset tonight. Jamila will not play with her."
"I spoke to Hassan.
I could not change his mind. He is a small-minded, bigoted man. To him, she is an American Jew and they are all evil. He will not see the good in Sophie. He won't give her a chance. He says Sophie will corrupt his daughter with blasphemous talk. I told him that is nonsense, that she is of our blood, but he is filled with hate of America. Nothing more can be done." "I am very sorry, Arif. Playing with Jamila was the one thing that brightened Sophie's day. It was the only thing that brought her out of her shell. Now she just sobs and looks out the window. She'll have to get over Jamila. We'll find her another playmate."
Lubana looked sternly at Al-Zahani.
"That's not the only reason she's upset tonight. And you know it."
Al-Zahani shrugged.
"She's upset because it's bedtime, and she can't find her stuffed animal. Her sweetness."
Al-Zahani nodded and kept reading. She raised her voice.
"Arif, do you know where it is?"
"Where what is?"
"The bear. Sophie's little bear. Have you seen it?"
"Why is that important?"
"The madrasa, her studies, those are important. Teaching her the history of our people, helping her to take her rightful place, that's important. And where are you in all this, Lubana? What are you doing to educate her? Are you helping her to become what she can be? A leader in our struggle? Or will she be just another silly woman buying produce at the markets? Are you teaching her, Lubana, or are you leaving it all to me? That stuffed animal is a crutch. It's an anchor to her past. I told you we should have it thrown out when we first got here. I'll hear no more of this bear." "You took it, didn't you? Despite my wishes, you took the bear from her."
Arif stood.
"And what if I did?"
"How dare you?"
Lubana yelled with her hands on her hips. Arif shook his head in disgust, stood, and flipped the back of his hand in a gesture of dismissal.
"Woman, don't ever raise your voice to me. Pay attention to your duties. The house should be cleaner. It shames me."
He checked his cell phone, turned, and walked toward the door.
"I'm going out. I have important business tonight. Don't wait up."
The group of 10 had resumed its meetings in the back of the Breadstone Bakery. To soothe Fakir's anxiety, each of the participants arrived at different times, from different directions. No one parked in front of the store.
"We are now 8 days away from our first mission of glory,"
Faiz said proudly.
"Does anything remain undone? Are we still processing bags?"
"We are," Al-Zahani answered. 40 a day, and we will keep on doing so until next week. We have nearly 2,000, all safely stored in our Jerusalem warehouse."
"I think we should shut down," Fakir said. "We have enough."
how much more impact will an additional 300 bags make? What if Aziz is detained? What if Arif's laboratory is discovered? We have been fortunate so far. Why chance it?
Faiz leaned back on the couch, his hands crossed on his abdomen.
Perhaps we should consider Fakir's suggestion.
Fakir is a coward, Nizar said. He's afraid of his shadow. How many times have we heard him scream, "The IDF!" He just doesn't want us to meet in his bakery anymore.
Nizar is quick to call names,
Al-Zahani said.
But here I agree with him. I am in the middle of production. I can stop. But 300 more victims. 300 more wailing, mortified families begging Israel to concede the land and stop the occupation. That has great value. 2,300 dead enemies will certainly be regarded as the most glorious jihadist victory since the Twin Towers, and right in the heart of our enemy. Do not fear the discovery of my lab. I have wired it for destruction. If necessary, I can instantly firebomb the building and obliterate all remnants of our operation. But we are close to the deadline, and is 2,000 so different from 2,300 that we should risk discovery?
Rami said.
Why chance an unforeseen accident exposing the plan? I can go along with Fakir. And you, Ahmed?
Faiz said. He nodded.
Fakir is wise. We are well positioned at this time. Arif can use the surplus bags for Tel Aviv. I too believe we should shut down,
Faiz said.
Let us just concentrate on Sami's deliveries. We'll meet again on Monday.
He reached for their hands.
From the river to the sea. From the Golan to the Gulf.
In a white minivan, parked on a corner near the bakery, two members of a specialized unit had listened to the discussion. Through a concealed aperture, pictures of the group were taken as they left the bakery.
Bags of what? One of the men said. 2,000 bags safely in a warehouse in Jerusalem. Sammy's deliveries. IEDs come to mind, but in the bag?
Chemicals?
I've never heard of chemical weapons dispersed from a bag, the other said. Could be anthrax.
8 days.
Isn't that the Yom Ha'atzmaut? Whatever it is, it's pegged to happen on Independence Day. Well, our job is to collect the info and send it on. Let's get it off to Tel Aviv and let them figure it out.
Chapter 61. It was shortly after 10 a.m. when Liam and Kayla walked into the chambers of the Honorable Nathan B. Kim on the second floor of the Prince Kuiyo Federal Building. They were accompanied by Michael Green, the first assistant U.S. attorney for the District of Hawaii.
Good morning, Your Honor, Green said. I'm here to present this petition for habeas corpus seeking the release of a prisoner named John Summers, presently held by the state of Hawaii at the HPD jail on Beartania. With me this morning is Kayla Cummings from the Department of State. Special Agent Harry Foster is available by telephone. Both of them are prepared to provide testimony that Summers is an essential participant in a classified U.S. operation in the Middle East.
Judge Kim read through the petition and set it down on his desk.
Your petition states that he is being held because of an outstanding warrant from Illinois. What are the pending charges?
Embezzlement, theft, possible implication in two homicides.
Let me hear from the Department of State,
Judge Kim said.
Kayla stepped forward. Mr. Summers has a child who has been kidnapped by a grandfather and taken to the city of Hebron, which is located in the Palestinian territories. The grandfather is a suspected terrorist and is thought to be involved in an impending jihadist operation. Summers was induced to participate in an embezzlement scheme in a misguided effort to rescue his daughter. The State Department intends to use Summers and a feigned ransom as a way of getting into the jihadist base to foil the operation. And we hope to rescue his daughter as well. It's very dangerous, but Summers has agreed to do it.
How much money is he alleged to have embezzled?
$88 million.
Judge Kim gave a low whistle.
And you say there are two homicides he's involved with?
There's no evidence he even knew about the homicides, Liam said.
Kayla nodded.
It appears that Summers was manipulated and induced to participate in an intricate fraud to misappropriate $88 million from an escrow account. We think that the mastermind of this scheme, a man named Dimitri, arranged for the kidnapping. He then promised Summers he'd secure his daughter's return if Summers would divert the escrow proceeds. Two of the other participants have been killed, and we believe that Summers is the next target. We're very concerned about his safety.
And there's no way of penetrating the terrorist ring without Summers?
No, sir.
Well, as to this habeas petition, we're not dealing with an unlawful detention. There is a warrant outstanding. I can't just release him. But I can remand him to the custody of the Department of State to be returned to the state of Illinois when the operation is concluded.
That'll work, she said.
What does the state of Illinois have to say about all this?
Mr. Forster has met with the Cook County State Attorney, who does not raise an objection to the release.
Although there are no promises, Illinois has agreed to consider Mr. Summers' corporation when the overseas operation is concluded, Kayla said. But as of today, there are no leniency agreements in place.
The judge picked up his telephone and asked his clerk to send in the court reporter.
We need to make a proper record before I sign this order. Let's get Mr. Forster on the phone. Each of you will supply the sworn testimony, Ms. Cummings.
1 hour after they had entered the federal building, Kayla and Liam walked out into the warmth of the morning sun. The morning mist that had covered the island when they arrived at the courthouse had burned away. Marcy, who'd been sitting on a bench in front of the building, jumped to her feet.
Did you get it?
Sure did,
Kayla answered. A signed court order demanding that Jack be immediately released into my custody. They quickly covered the 5 blocks to the police station, where they asked for Sergeant Hanley.
Doesn't come until tonight, the desk sergeant said.
Kayla produced the court order and placed it on the counter.
This is an order to take immediate custody of John Summers. He was brought in last night.
The sergeant nodded and took the order back into a windowed office. Several minutes passed. Finally, a man in a blue suit, open collar, and loosened tie shuffled out of the back office and walked over with the order in his hand.
I'm Captain Nelson. We don't have a John Summers here. In fact, all the guys who came in last night were sent over to bond court this morning, except for one.
Who's the one? Liam said.
Eugene Wilson.
That's John Summers. Eugene Wilson is John Summers.
Well, he was booked as Eugene Wilson, and he was sent over to Oahu Correctional this morning, awaiting extradition. There's a note that he has an Illinois warrant outstanding under an alias. There'll be no bond for him.
I have an order placing him in my custody, Kayla said. Will you please go get him? Send a car.
Nelson shook his head.
He's in DOC custody. You'll have to take your order over to the warden. There's nothing I can do for you.
Could you at least make a call? Have him brought to the front office? I'm worried about his safety.
Warden Jennings is a tough guy. He won't listen to me. Just go on up there. Show him your order.
Where's the prison?
Up on Kamehameha. Not too far. Don't worry, though. Summers isn't going anywhere. He'll still be there.
Captain, this man is crucial to a State Department operation, Kayla said, showing him her ID. There are people who don't want him to cooperate with us, people who want him dead. He has to be protected. You've got to go get him.
I'm sorry, ma'am, that's way above my pay grade. I don't tell wardens what to do.
A federal judge does, Kayla said.
Yes, he does. So go get a federal marshal or take that order up there yourself. It's just a few blocks away.
One more thing, Liam said. What happened to the officer who got shot last night?
He'll be okay. He was shot in the leg.
Did they catch the guys who shot him?
The captain shook his head.
Nope, not yet. They ditched their car up at the convention center. The security cameras showed them splitting up and running off in different directions. But they were driving a rental car and paid for it with a credit card. We got a few leads. We'll catch them.
He smiled.
Liam, they'll try to get Summers at the jail. He could be dead before we get there, Kayla said.
Captain, Liam said, the guys who shot your officer last night were waiting for Summers to leave the building. For all I know, they may have people on the inside of the prison who'll take care of business for them. Can you help me get him segregated?
I'll call, but Warden Jennings runs things his way. He doesn't like interference.
Our flight to Osaka leaves in 30 minutes. We've already checked in, the tall man said into a cell phone.
That's good. Good. From there you can make it safely to Moscow. Are you sure everything is taken care of?
Without a doubt. Yuri knows his assignment. He will not let you down. He was arrested 3 days ago, and of course he did not try to make Bond. At visiting hour this morning, he told us he would take care of the matter in the yard or at midday meal. There are always fights.
I will provide a lawyer for Yuri. He will bond out. He's only charged with theft. He will soon join us. Your loyalty will be rewarded, Evgeny. I will see you later this month in Moscow.
The line went dead. Evgeny put the cell phone in his pocket and tugged at the sleeve of his companion.
Come on, Grigor. Our flight is boarding. We're going home. Dmitri is proud of us.
Chapter 62. Since arriving at the prison in the early morning hours, Summers had settled into the corner of his cell, cross-legged on the floor. The cell had 6 beds and 6 mattresses, but a 350-pound Samoan had taken 3 of the mattresses for himself. Summers, discreetly choosing not to argue the point, took his place in the corner, pondering all of the possibilities, and praying that Liam and Kayla would somehow find a way to get him released. At 8:30 a.m., the doors on a cell block clanged open, and the prisoners were allowed to mingle on the block. The noise, the level of shouting, the clanging on the bars was both insufferable and terrifying. Summers remained in his cell, sitting in the corner, with Sophie haunting his thoughts. At 11:50, his wing was assembled and led to the dining hall for lunch. Most of the men at his table were loud, boisterous, and even light-hearted, the incongruity of which Summers found unsettling. As he sat with his lunch tray, Summers felt eyes on him. A tall, muscular man with buzz-cut, widow's-peaked hair, and a crescent scar on his right cheek, sitting 2 tables away, was staring at him. Summers kept averting his eyes, but from time to time he'd take a quick check. There was no doubt. The man continued to glare. Summers felt vulnerable and longed for the seclusion of his cell. A heavy man to his right, with tattoos covering both of his hairy arms, pointed at the plate of spam and greens that sat before Summers.
"You gonna eat that?"
he said in a low voice. Summers shook his head and pushed the plate to the side, leaving only his juice and the crackers that came with his meal. The man with the scar never took his eyes off him. A bell rang and the lunch crowd stood in unison. They made a quick turn toward the aisle and shuffled forward. The man with the scar was gone. Liam, Kayla, and Marcy arrived at the prison just after noon. The warden, a hefty man in his mid-50s, was in his office and about to leave for a meeting with the lieutenant governor.
"How can I help you, miss?"
Kayla handed the order to the warden.
"We're here to take custody of John Summers, also known as Eugene Wilson."
Warden Jennings spent a long time studying the paper, making twisting movements with his lips.
"All in good time. Eugene Wilson was brought in early this morning. He may still be in processing."
Warden Jennings sat behind a broad desk of polished koa. Flags of the United States and the state of Hawaii were perched in stands on either side. A framed picture of Jennings and the governor, in their Bermuda shorts on the first tee of Wai'ele Country Club, sat on the corner of his desk. He picked up his phone, said a few words, listened, nodded, shrugged his shoulders, and ended with,
"I'll let them know."
He looked across his desk.
"His wing's at lunch. He'll be back in his cell in about 40 minutes.
"Will you have him brought up here immediately, please?" Kayla said.
"There's good reason to believe he could be attacked in a group setting. It might be a mistake to let him go to lunch." The warden shook his head.
"Listen, young lady, I have a prison to run here, and we're pretty careful about mistakes. I don't like your insinuations. Besides, it's easier for us to bring him from a cell than to have one of my guards take him from a lunch table.
There'll be a lot of unhappy people in Washington if anything happens to John Summers," Liam said.
The warden leaned over his desk.
Are you threatening me, Mr. Taggart? Was that a threat?
I don't answer to people in Washington. I answer to the people of the state of Hawaii and the governor who appointed me.
The warden sat back in his chair and smiled.
When Mr. Summers finishes his lunch, and he's marched back to his cell, and if there's a guard available that can be spared from his duties, I will consider having him brought up front.
The warden stood and hitched up his trousers. He took a suit jacket from the hook behind the door and slipped it on, checking his appearance in the mirror.
Now, if you ladies and gentlemen will wait on the chairs outside by Miss Figgins, I have to leave for an important policy meeting with Lieutenant Governor Duncan's. I'll take care of this matter when I return.
As they walked through the office doorway, a buzzer alarm sounded. The warden quickly grabbed a phone. He listened and looked sheepishly at Liam.
There's been an incident in the lunch hall. Your man's been injured. Apparently he was involved in a fight. They're taking him to the infirmary.
Son of a bitch, Liam said. Just 1 minute, son. Who the fuck do you think? Before he could finish, Kayla dialed Judge Kim on her cell phone. She spoke a few words and handed the phone to Jennings.
Yes, sir. I understand, said the warden saccharinely.
Of course, Your Honor, we're taking all immediate steps to comply with your order. This young lady has only been here a few minutes, and we are already in the process of having the prisoner rushed to my office. But unfortunately, before I could act, there was an incident.
Mr. Summers got himself involved in an altercation, and he was stabbed by an unknown assailant.
We're taking him to the infirmary.
The hell you are, Kayla interrupted. He's in my custody. You get an ambulance here, now. He's going to a hospital.
Well, Your Honor, Jennings said smugly into the phone. Seems like my responsibilities are concluded. The young lady says she's going to take custody of Mr. Summers and have him brought to a hospital. I want you to know that we are terminating our protective custody of this man. He is no longer in the care of the Department of Corrections.
5 minutes later, paramedics arrived and were directed into the facility where Summers lay bleeding. They wheeled him out on a stretcher and into the EMS van. Bandages on his back and left side were turning red. Oxygen and fluids were being administered. Jack gazed weakly at Marcy, who frantically scrambled up into the van to sit beside him. She grabbed Summers' hand and squeezed.
Hang on, Jack. Be strong. There's a lot for us to do.
Sophie,
Jack said softly. You must,
he swallowed.
You must. I'll get her, Jack, whatever I need to do. You can count on it.
Summers was rushed to the Queen's Medical Center and wheeled into the emergency room. When Liam and Kayla arrived, Marcy told them that a surgical team was already at work. Hours went by. They paced the waiting room, intermittently strolling by the receptionist to ask if she had any news. They stared blankly at the little TV hanging from the ceiling. They fed money into the vending machines. They fidgeted. Finally, a young doctor came out, and the group scrambled to encircle him.
He's hanging in there. Good thing you got him here quickly. He wouldn't have lasted much longer.
Of course, his condition is critical. His vital signs are not yet stable, but I would not say his indicators are necessarily unfavorable.
Doctor, Marcy said and shrugged, what does that mean?
His injuries were very serious, and he required a lot of repair. We're hopeful, but he's not out of the woods yet. In some ways, he was very lucky. He was stabbed with a narrow knife. There are 3 entry points, 2 on his back and 1 on his side. Although they caused damage, none of his vital organs was beyond repair. How well they'll heal remains to be seen. If he stabilizes, as I hope he will, he'll need rest, medications, fluids. He'll probably be here for quite a while.
What's quite a while? Kayla asked.
Oh, it could be weeks. There's organ damage, muscle damage. Walking without assistance will be out of the question for at least 4 weeks. Given his injuries, I expect a considerable rehab period.
I don't think we have that much time, Kayla said.
I may have to move him. The doctor shook his head.
I don't know what you have in mind, but he can't be moved.
No, doctor, the question is, how soon can he be moved? She said firmly.
You mean if he survives?
What's wrong with you? Marcy snapped at Kayla.
We're talking about Jack's life. Don't you care anything about his life?
His life and many, many more, Marcy. He may be our only hope of diverting a catastrophe.
You can't move this man, the doctor said. And that's final.
Who's his next of kin?
He has a sister in Louisville,
Marcy said. As of right now, this court order makes me his next of kin, Kayla said. I'll decide when and if he should be moved.
You bitch, Marcy said.
Calm down, Marcy. I want him alive as much as you do.
Doctor, I want him to get the very best care this hospital can provide. The United States government will stand for all expenses. I want the best specialists on the island. I want you to treat this man as though he were the President of the United States. Are we clear?
Clear.
So how long are you going to be in Hawaii? With the demure Miss Cummings, I might add,
Catherine said. Demure? Should have seen her today. She was as cuddly as a porcupine.
If Summer survives, we're going to stay here until she can move him, which I would guess will be several days.
So, can I get you to fly out?
If Summer survives?
That's what the doctor said.
Stop changing the subject. Will you come out? We have some unfinished business. Can I buy you a ticket?
I don't know. I'm very busy. I'm really putting in some heavy hours.
Let me think about it. Does Summers know who tried to kill him?
No. He was standing at the lunch table when a guy came up from behind and stuck a shiv in his ribs. That's the last he remembers. HPD says the assailant's name was Yuri Porushkin, a Russian citizen here on an expired visa. He was arrested a couple of days before Summers on a charge of breaking into a jewelry store display case at the Westin and grabbing a handful of watches. At 8 in the evening in a busy hotel.
Sounds like he wanted to get arrested.
That's what I think.
But I want you to come out here after the deposition.
Liam, the only thing on my mind right now is Victor Kelson's depo tomorrow. If you think you'll be there for a while, I'll think about it. But no promises.
I think if Kayla had her way, she'd bring him to Hebron tomorrow. But the doctors won't let her move him. I'm sure we'll be here for some time.
Liam, did you say the assailant was a Russian named Yuri Porushkin?
Yes.
You're sure he's a Russian?
That's what they said, on an expired visa. It seems like the Russians are all over this.
Summers told us that he and Harrington made the deal to steal Kelson's money at a bar in Wrigleyville with a Russian named Dmitri. Dmitri has contacts in the Middle East and was supposed to set up the ransom. Sophie's release in exchange for some of the embezzled money. And the motel clerk, before he caught a bullet in the chest, said that the men who came looking for Summers spoke with a Russian accent.
Liam, Kelson's connected to Dmitri.
How do you know that?
I can't tell you, but Kelson, Dmitri, and a man named Yevgeny have been involved in fixing sporting events. Kelson's in bed with the Russians. They've been working together.
But Dmitri stole Kelson's money.
He doesn't seem like a very good partner, does he?
Do we know anything more about this Dmitri character, like where he lives and where he banks?
No, only the first name.
I wonder if Kelson suspects Dimitri's behind the embezzlement.
I doubt it. He's certain Summer stole the money.
You should see him in court. He has to be restrained by his lawyers. He has so much rage.
I doubt that he has any notion that Dmitri has his money.
We need more information on Dmitri. What if you were to bring up Dimitri's name a couple of times at Kelson's deposition tomorrow? Just throw it out there. See what happens.
That's a great idea.
I get him now and then.
That's why we make such a good couple. We're so damn diabolical. Love you, Liam.
Do you really think we make a good couple?
What?
Of course I do.
Why did you say that?
No reason.
Love you too.